This is KUOW's The Record. Let's get at local news today. I'm Bill Radke. About 5,000 Seattle area students walked out of school yesterday to protest the election of Donald J. Trump. Franklin High School senior Quinn Angelou Lysacker helped organize the event. She spoke to me earlier today from an empty school hallway, and I asked her how she got the idea of a walkout.
Well, there had been sort of rumors going around about it this past week. There was a screenshot sort of being passed around through social media, but no obvious, like, organizer. There was no event page, but I knew Garfield and Cleveland and possibly some other schools were considering that. But there really had been no work, no rumors about it at Franklin. And so I was contacted by a teacher who encouraged me, like, hey, you could totally take initiative and try to get Franklin on board with this. And so really it was just within about 12 hours, spent my whole Sunday like hovering over the event page, trying to get everybody invited and in on it. I got in contact with Socialist Alternative, who offered to help us out with some signs and a bullhorn. And so, yeah.
You know, Quinn, some of the student protesters were chanting, "Not my president." And my first reaction was, this is how democracy works. It is your president. What are they teaching you in government class? What's your take?
Well, I don't think anyone meant that, like, literally. Like, they know that he is the president-elect, at least. But his bigotry does not represent us. His sexism, his racism, his misogyny, I think that's our message there. Like, he doesn't represent us. He's not our president. We don't identify with him, even though he may literally be running our country. We're not with anything that he stands for. So I think that was our message there. Same way with we reject the president-elect. Yeah, I think that was our message.
You told me that there was a debrief today during school. What was that conversation like in school?
Well, I'm part of the Humanities Academy at Franklin, and we're definitely a social justice-based school. The event itself was completely student-organized, but I think our teachers were very supportive of us and wanted to hear how it went, even though they weren't technically allowed to help us organize or, you know, attend the walkout. They were really all really proud of us for organizing that, especially on such short notice. Franklin really only got involved yesterday. It was a really quick thing to put together. So yeah, they just wanted to hear, like, were there any altercations with police? Were there, like, what were you guys chanting? Who was helping out? Yeah, really positive discussion. There was no criticism at all from teachers at Franklin, at least.
So your take is that both students and teachers felt good, felt proud about the protest. Where does that leave a Trump-supporting Franklin High School student?
You know, that's a fascinating thing. I think that was definitely something we had to navigate when putting this together. Like, just leave notes on all of our posts. Like, if you are a Trump supporter, this message is not for you. Franklin has a large population of first-generation students, a lot of undocumented students, and they're terrified. They're not just angry. They're like scared for their own future. And I think we had to direct that energy somewhere. And so I would encourage any Trump supporting Franklin student to just consider the very real fear that's going on around them, regardless of any sort of political division. Like, that's genuine. And we had to put that somewhere and just show our community that we stand with them. It wasn't even necessarily an anti-Trump. Well, it wasn't anti-Trump protest. I can't quite say that. But our message was definitely more focused on just showing solidarity with those of us who don't feel heard or respected or safe right now.
Finally, Quinn, we want to know, what's your next action?
Next action. Well, definitely in Senior Humanities, we already have groups of students working on various projects. One student in particular I know is working on, we're going to be sending bricks to Donald Trump. I know he wants to build a wall. We figure we might as well send him some bricks, and they'll be individually painted with messages to him. I'm working on getting
Wait a minute. Why send him his bricks for his wall?
Well, we're obviously against the idea of extreme border control that way with a big wall. We don't believe in walls. We believe in bridges. And so it's in a way a joke, but also just it sends a message like, if you're going to build a wall, use these bricks. Use these bricks that really express what you mean by this. It's about division. It's about racism and xenophobia. And so we'll be sending him bricks, not to be literally used for the wall, but just to send that message.
Quinn, I know you need to get back to class. Any final word for us? Final message?
Just that I'm feeling really good about this. The outcome of the election is hard on everyone in my community, but it's really exciting to see that kids are willing to get a little scrappy, get a little disobedient in order to send their message. I think we all really showed our true character yesterday.
Quinn Angelou Lysacker is a senior at Franklin High School, and at the time she spoke with us, she was supposed to be in second period humanities. But this was not a walkout. Quinn got a hall pass. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. You know, one candidate for Trump's administration is Rudy Giuliani, who as New York's mayor backed a controversial policing philosophy known as broken windows policing. We're going to take a closer look at the broken windows theory and what it tells us about the tensions between police and communities today. That's coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Will the Sonics return to Seattle along with the NHL? Would they play in Key Arena or a new stadium in SoDo? Into all of these questions steps Russell Wilson. I know, he's football, but the Seahawks quarterback has joined the investment group trying to build a new basketball and hockey arena in the SoDo neighborhood. Tim Booth covers sports for the AP, and he says this Russell Wilson play is a surprise.
You know, it's a surprise, I think, a little bit because of the timing of it, but I don't think it's necessarily a surprise that Russell Wilson was interested in doing something like this. He's expressed before kind of an interest in having, you know, his hand in sports after his football career is done. And whether that was through, you know, being a team owner or having, you know, a stake in something, he hadn't really expressed that before. And I think this is kind of the first time we're seeing truly kind of what he wants to do. And clearly, it's having, you know, an interest in getting the NBA back to Seattle in some fashion.
NFL careers are short. Maybe Russell Wilson wants to be a permanent part of Seattle?
Yeah, you know, this certainly establishes even deeper roots for him here in the Northwest and in Seattle. He hasn't hid how much he enjoys living here. So this is just another sign that he has a kind of a long-term interest in the future of what Seattle becomes outside of his football career.
You said you found the timing interesting. What do you mean?
This is not something that usually comes up in the middle of the season. This is more the type of thing that happens in the off season. You know, when the NFL is kind of quiet. Typically, announcements like this usually don't come right after playing on Sunday Night Football and beating the New England Patriots.
Right. This is supposed to be Richard Sherman news conferences and pass interference arguments happening right now.
Yes, exactly. But I think right now the arena thing is bubbling. There's movement going on right now, and from a PR standpoint, from a get the public excited standpoint, having Russell Wilson's name attached to the SoDo project is a big deal.
Russell's got $87 million in Seahawks contract money burning a hole in his pocket. How much is he kicking in?
That's kind of an unknown right now, and I don't think it'll be much. To me, I kind of equate it a little bit with what Drew Carey's investment was in the Sounders. It was a minimal sort of investment. Granted, it's on a completely different scale between an MLS franchise and trying to get an arena and an NBA team here. But the name recognition, I think, is the more powerful sort of currency with Russell's involvement here. You know, maybe the biggest celebrity in the Pacific Northwest right now is a huge currency for what they're trying to get done.
Some listeners might not have followed the dueling stadium situation. Could you briefly recap that?
Yeah, just the Chris Hansen announced, you know, last month that he intended to privately finance the SoDo Arena, basically take the memorandum of understanding that was agreed upon back in 2012 and rip it up and say, hey, we don't need the public bonds. We don't need that piece of the investment. Basically, all we need now from the city is the okay to vacate Occidental, and we can put a shovel in the ground and start building because we're going to privately pay for that. Almost at the exact same time, there was news that came out regarding the future of Key Arena. And I don't think anyone involved in this process will disagree that something has to happen with the west side of Seattle Center. And Key Arena is kind of the anchor of that. And so there needs to be something done there, whether that's as a professional sports venue, as a concert venue, as a civic gathering place. That's kind of the question going forward. And so that's kind of been the news behind Key Arena of late, is that the city is going to look deeper into the options. That process is going to play out over the next probably 3 to 6 months with the hopes that there are formal proposals to the city in hand for potential future options for Key Arena sometime, you know, early to mid 2017.
Bottom line, Tim, does this improve the chances that Chris Hansen builds in Soto?
I think it does. I think ultimately when we get down to the when the RFPs come back on Key Arena, I think we're going to realize that from an overall infrastructure standpoint, Soto is the best option. You know, Key Arena can be redeveloped, but when you couple in the transportation difficulties, the limited footprint that Key Arena has, although there are certain limitations on Key Arena that just cannot be fixed immediately, whereas a new arena can take care of a lot of those issues, plus it's in an area where there's more public transportation options. And I think ultimately, a year from now, I think we'll be talking about Chris Hansen's project being the winner in this and that is moving forward at that time.
Well, we'll see whether any of those five city council members will change their minds and agree with you.
No, it's a big question. It's a huge question because the backlash that happened after the vacation of Occidental vote previously was a big deal, and it was extremely poor representation of what Chris Hansen's group is trying to get done and of Sonics fans as a whole. I mean, it was a terrible reaction that a lot of fans had and expressed it outwardly toward those city council members. There's got to be some winning over of them again in order to make this happen. But I think when they look at it after the Key Arena reports come back, I think it's going to make logically a lot of sense for the Soto site to be the preferred site.
Tim Booth covers sports for the AP. Tim, good talking with you about this. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
I also asked him, hey, how come Russell Wilson cares so much about the Sonics or NHL hockey in Seattle? And he said, oh, Wilson says he played a lot of the NBA Jam video game when he was a kid, that he would terrorize his brother with Sean Kemp throwing his elbows on the boards. No, Russell Wilson did not grow up in Seattle. He grew up in Virginia. But there you go. That's the national power of the Rain Man. This is KOW's The Record. Did you know there are special courts for military veterans? More than 300 state and local government courts to deal with former service members in trouble with the law and help them address problems like PTSD and substance abuse. Advocates say the courts prevent future arrests and they save taxpayers money. But their growth across America has been haphazard. Reporter Jay Price visited a veterans treatment court in North Carolina.
All rise, please.
In many ways, this seems like a typical courtroom.
Well, yes. It's on District 11A Veterans Treatment Court, County Harnett, sitting for the dispatch of business.
But what goes on during the weekly sessions of the Harnett County Veterans Treatment Court is just the most visible part of a hybrid approach to justice.
So, you know, we would really prefer for you to be in more therapy, but you're sort of resistant to that.
In this courtroom, veterans charged with minor crimes come before a judge who understands what they went through as service members. Judge Jackie Lee isn't here to make a quick decision about whether they go to jail. Instead, she works with each of them for months as they undergo intensive mentoring and treatment to end substance abuse, deal with mental health problems like PTSD, and even solve family and job problems.
We owe it to our veterans. They have gone through so much for our country. And we have an obligation to look after them when they come back, when those issues create obstacles to live in society again.
One of the veterans that Judge Lee and the rest of the court is looking after is Wilton McKenzie.
They point me in the right direction to get me the help that I need, because I was not that type of person before the military.
The 43-year-old McKenzie has an appealing laugh that he uses a lot, close-cropped hair as if he were still in the Army, and until recently a charge hanging over him of assault on a female. But he just finished up more than a year and a half of treatment and counseling. Mark Tichy, himself a retired Army lieutenant colonel, coordinates the treatment court. 21 veterans have successfully passed through it since 2014.
Zero recidivism rate. That means nobody's been rearrested. That's remarkable.
That's similar to outcomes in veterans treatment courts around the country since the first one opened in Buffalo, New York in 2008. Early research suggests that the courts are saving taxpayers millions of dollars in court, jail, and prison costs, as well as things that can't be tallied, like crimes that have been prevented. Scott Swaim is director of the nonprofit group Justice for Vets. His group now counts 306 veterans treatment courts nationwide, but that total increases almost weekly.
Between 2008 and 2010, maybe there were 20 or 30. So, you know, you figure just in the last 5 or 6 years, it's expanded that much.
But even with growth like that, the courts aren't everywhere that they're needed. North Carolina, for example, has 3, with a 4th opening soon. Advocates estimate the state needs as many as 17. And some other states with big veterans populations have just 1 or 2. Swaim says not every community that needs a court has someone motivated enough to create one.
Some judge somewhere has to say, yeah, I think it's a great idea, whether it's, you know, or some legislator for some states, you know, has to legislate it and say, yes, we believe veterans treatment courts have value, and yes, you can start one.
Another impediment is money. The VA pays for much of the counseling, but in most states, there's no ongoing funding for the court's startup and operating costs other than short-term grants. As for Harnett County, it was fortunate. It got 3 years of state startup grants before winning a $1.4 million federal grant this fall. That new money will let it expand and help more veterans like Wilton McKenzie.
Work to fight for the right and to build the nation's might as the Army goes rolling along.
Like other veterans who've completed the program in Judge Lee's courtroom, McKenzie didn't just have his charges dropped. He got a formal graduation ceremony. Family, friends, and the assigned mentors of the day's 3 graduates came to watch and to join in. And if they're like all the other graduates so far, this is their last brush with the law.
You know, I can tell you, these people will never see me again here, not unless they ask me to come to, you know, visit. It'll be off my record. Everything will be off my record.
All over the country now, more and more veterans are graduating like this, back into their lives. This is Jay Price reporting.
And that story was produced by the American Homefront Project, which is a collaboration of KUOW and North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, and Southern California Public Radio, and WUSF in Tampa. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Western Washington's Grays Harbor County hasn't voted Republican for president since 1928. Until last week. We're going to talk about why that is in about 15 minutes. But first, we're starting to get signs of what President-elect Donald Trump might actually do in office. And we know trade is high on that list. So what will a Trump presidency mean for Puget Sound area businesses? Let's find out from the editor-in-chief of the Puget Sound Business Journal, Emily Parkhurst. Welcome.
Thanks, Bill.
Since the election, we have seen protests. We just met a student who organized a school walkout. How have local businesses been reacting?
You know, I think it really has been mixed. You've got some folks here in the local business community who are very excited about Trump's election. And I think a lot of those folks are in the real estate industry and in the biotechnology industry.
Why real estate and biotech?
You know, I think for biotech, it was really related to the fact that Hillary Clinton had made a lot of indications that she intended to regulate pharmaceutical industry and the prices of drugs. And for the biotech industry that develops a lot of those drugs, that was a scary proposition for them. So having Trump in office is pretty much an indication that, that regulation is not likely to happen.
What are a couple of big local big pharma companies?
You know, we've got a lot of cancer researchers here, and cancer drugs tend to be extremely expensive and would likely have been directly impacted by any kind of regulations, big pharma regulations.
And real estate?
So for real estate, I think, you know, there's a lot of Chinese investors here investing in the Puget Sound region. And so there's some question about whether that will continue. But for the most part, the real estate industry is very excited about a Trump presidency because of the likelihood that regulations are not going to come down the pike for, you know, home loans, things like that, where, you know, that could potentially impact the number of people that could be purchasing houses. And I think what we're going to see under Trump presidency is a sort of an opening up of the home loan process, which will make it even easier for folks to buy houses here and qualify for the loans necessary to buy houses here.
Okay, so deregulation could create some local winners. Who stands to lose with President Trump here?
You know, I think if you were to talk to anybody in the business community in the Puget Sound region right now, trade is the number one thing that they're thinking about. And that is always, of course, directly connected to Boeing. Boeing is a huge employer in this state. And we're already seeing a softening of the what's called the wide body market, which is the bigger Boeing jets. And there was some indication today that there's also a softening of the 737 market, which is the smaller jets.
Softening meaning fewer orders?
Yeah, it's not really translating to fewer orders yet. But what it's translating to is people kind of moving backwards on whether they're going to make those orders. So it's sort of promises for orders, like instead of the actual orders themselves. And that's usually an indication of a global slowdown. You know, the kinds of organizations that are buying big jets, those are countries, right? So if you know, a lot of different countries are saying, yeah, we're going to wait, and maybe we're not going to buy 30 737s next year. We're going to wait a year or two and see how that works out. That's going to translate directly here to jobs.
What about the Trump trade picture outside of Boeing?
Yeah, so I mean, outside of Boeing, there's a lot of concern. Yeah, the manufacturing industry here is heavily dependent on relations with China, but also, you know, Mexico and a lot of other countries around the Pacific Rim. There's the discussion of the TPP. And I think that, you know, you've got indications from Trump that the TPP and NAFTA are not things that he really supports. And as a result, you've got a lot of businesses here saying, okay, if we're not going to get the TPP, what's that going to mean for the future of trade with, say, Mexico, with China? And I think that there's a lot of uncertainty there. Markets don't like uncertainty. And I think you're going to see some sort of tightening up of markets as a result.
Let's say more about the China effect. Here we are on the Pacific Rim, and we've heard about the possible U.S.-China animosity under Trump. What are you seeing happening?
You know, I think for Boeing in particular, that is a scary proposition. China, I believe it's 20% of Boeing's orders right now are from China. You know, if China decides, and they've already indicated that they are developing their own jet market in China and building their own jets there, possibly in connection with Russia and some of the Russian manufacturers. If that happens, that will almost certainly result in fewer jets coming out of Boeing and heading to China. Boeing is opening a finishing factory in China, and Trump specifically cited that as something that he did not think would be a good thing for the U.S. and that he would like to bring those jobs back to the U.S. And so, you know, China's relationship with Boeing is right now really strong, and if that starts to fade away, that has a direct impact, I think, on jobs here in the Puget Sound region. It also, you know, there's also a kind of a complicated relationship there because you've got Boeing also moving a lot of jobs to South Carolina.
Right.
And so the combination of the two, you've got this feeling that manufacturing here in the Pacific Northwest is starting to fade away a little bit, but it's not necessarily fading away to China. In a lot of cases, it's headed to the southeast.
What's Amazon? We just have less than a minute. What's Amazon's stake in China, very briefly?
Well, Amazon has a huge stake in China. It's, yeah. You know, the growing middle class there is really interested in buying goods. And then Amazon has this massive cloud play. You know, Amazon Web Services is a huge and the fastest growing part of Amazon's business. And their biggest competitor right now in China is Alibaba, which is a Chinese company. And so if trade relations between the U.S. and China decline, you know, Alibaba has more control over the Chinese market already, that's only going to be exacerbated. It's going to make it even harder for Amazon to do business over there. And Alibaba has said that they're moving into the cloud market, and they're moving pretty hard and fast into that. They see an opportunity there, and that could potentially impact Amazon. I'm not sure it will impact them long term. I don't think this is going to be a huge decline in the next 10 years, but I think it could have an impact now.
Puget Sound Business Journal Editor-in-Chief Emily Parkhurst. Emily, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. No American is as misunderstood as the indigenous person. So say Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker. They've written a new book called All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. Roxanne says for most Americans, learning about Native life ends at Hollywood Westerns and grade school textbooks.
In Hollywood Westerns, you have Indians dying over and over and over again. They never win, it's just they get, and every movie they're dying. So for generations of young people growing up, that's what they see: dead Indians being killed, and they see it as a triumph, that because they're the enemy. So this then means that all the real Indians, that is the authentic Indians, those that survived, assimilated, they're just other Americans. So the real Indians, the authentic Indians, are said to no longer exist.
Can I ask, what is the myth of the dead Indians? What does that do for the dominant American culture? It survives because it's accomplished, it's useful. Mm-hmm. What's the use?
Well, it reinforces another narrative, which is all about European superiority. And that's a narrative that follows the Europeans, the very earliest Europeans. I mean, these are people who are, they're Puritans, they're the people of God. They have, it's already built in to their own belief systems that they are the righteous ones, the chosen ones, and they have the right to inherit the land. And so this is something, again, that gets played out over and over again over centuries. And to this day, the system of federal Indian law is built on this underlying narrative of European cultural and religious superiority.
Do you trace this story of European superiority down to today's Dakota Access Pipeline standoff, today's presidential election? What connections are you making?
In a way, this particular pipeline is like the last straw. No more, so taking a stand. So it's a continuation of history for the Sioux people, but for, say, a new generation, especially of Americans, they say, wow, this is, they didn't know any of this history. So it is a learning process, and it's one of the few times ever that there has been a really positive media coverage. Now, to lead, the presidential election, this puts a kind of pall on everything, first of all, you don't have any idea what President Trump is going to do. But one thing we know is he's filled with revenge, and he does hate Native Americans because of the casinos and his failure in Atlantic City. He's a bad businessman, went bankrupt, but he blames Indian casinos for taking away his business. So he has an actual, vengeance. So it's not going to be a good time, for Native people and the federal government.
I want to touch on another myth in your book because it's gotten so much attention lately in the World Series, and that is the Cleveland Indians and the Washington Redskins and the myth of honoring indigenous people. Will you tell us what that myth is?
Yes, that's one of the most pernicious ones. And I think in some ways, the hardest to explain to people because they think, well, Native people just don't have a sense of humor. This is sports. This is a game. But it's also the imagery of sort of like the Nazi era, how Jews were depicted in cartoons and all. And we see this with Muslims, too, being depicted in these hateful ways. And it's bad enough to have Cleveland Indians or the warriors or the chiefs and all those things, and also military equipment by those names. But Redskins is beyond the pale. I feel that when people really know the history of that term, where it comes from, why it was used very early on in Massachusetts Bay Colony, the bounties for heads of Indians. This was became a commerce in itself. The way people made their living was killing Indians and bringing the heads in, and blood has flown. So they're Redskins. I mean, if you take a look at Native people, their skin is not red. It's brown, you know. Brown or many colors, sometimes often towards black or very light, but never is it red. Only white people are pink sometimes, or orange.
said natives don't have sense of humor. Which is it?
It's, you know what? It's Indian sense of humor. We always say this in Indian country. If it wasn't for our ability to laugh, we wouldn't have survived. It's something that all Indian people know. And so there's a certain, like, Indian humor.
That's a sort of gallows humor.
It is a gallows humor. Being able to laugh in the middle of the darkest, most, you know, morose situations.
Is that an important myth? I don't know if it actually makes your book as a myth, but the sort of joyless image.
That's right. The solemn.
Stoic
the wooden,
Indian.
Wooden Indian. Yeah. You know, the wooden Indian as a symbol of that. And so Indians aren't supposed to talk. You know, they're supposed to be mute. I love that in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the Will Sampson character who could talk, but he wasn't talking. But he fit
the big
that.
Chief.
He was portrayed as that image of the silent Indian. And it then becomes a demand, keep your mouth shut, you know, Indians aren't supposed to talk.
What do you wish a white American would think? We think in images, we think in stereotypes. What's an image you wish people had? Indian, and the myth is what, or the image is what?
They don't necessarily fit any particular image. They don't necessarily have dark skin. They don't necessarily have long black hair. They don't necessarily have dark eyes. They don't wear feathers and beads. They might wear suits, and they do. They wear spacesuits. John Harrington, famous Chickasaw astronaut, is at the top of his league. He's a scientist. He's an astronaut, and he's very, very rooted in his culture. We tell a story in the book about John Harrington, who goes into space. He flew into space and went to the International Space Station, and he brought with him eagle feathers, he brought sage, and he brought the flag of the Chickasaw Nation. So he even though he went out into space, he brought all those symbols of his identity. That was a form of resistance for him, of not fitting into any kind of prescribed image or role. And that's really what you're talking about, a myth that Indians can't be modern. That's tied to erasure and Indians not being able to live up to these impossible ideals that are stuck in a frozen past. Indians can only be real in extinct past, which is a real catch-22. But connected to that is this idea that in order to be Indian, you can't be modern. You can't fit these images. But Native people are doing it all the time. And so that's what I wish for dominant society to get.
Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Julia Whitaker wrote the new book, All the Real Indians Died Off, and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. They are not Trump fans, as you heard, which puts them in league with most of Western Washington, but not all. There are four Western Washington counties that flipped this election, from Obama in 2012 to Donald Trump: Mason, Pacific, Cowlitz, and Grays Harbor County, where they haven't voted Democrat for president. I should say they haven't voted Republican for president since 1928. I asked the chair of the Grays Harbor Republican Party, Jim Walsh, why the Trump flip?
I think that we were disappointed here that the change that Obama brought was not the kind of change we'd hoped for that would have, was going to help the economy in this area. And so I think the voters here are taking a flyer on another presidential candidate that they think might bring change and hopefully the kind of change that helps us.
So Grays Harbor voters thought that President Obama was going to help reopen mills and bring back logging and commercial fishing type jobs?
Well, I don't know if they ever really thought it through that far. I think they bought into a general message of change and improvement, and they didn't hold the president and the federal electeds around here to that level of specific measurement. I think that the voters here believed that things like the Affordable Care Act were going to really make life better, and we've really suffered here in terms of the quality of health care services delivered. And so I think also in this area there's some frustration with all that.
So let's talk about how Grays Harbor voters will hold President Trump accountable. What specifically needs to happen in your county for this to be a red county again 4 years from now?
We just talked about the ACA. I think if whatever reforms the president-elect and his administration can make to health care services delivery, if they make things better. I mean, we have a problem out here right now, particularly keeping specialists, doctor specialists, and particularly pediatricians is kind of the flashpoint right now. We're having a hard time keeping pediatricians around here. If that kind of problem can be fixed, if we can get pediatricians to come and stay, then I think some of the frustration here will be lightened, and I think that would be considered a measure of success. We continue to struggle with a high unemployment rate here. I mean, so if we could consistently bring that metric down, obviously that would be a big help. And I mean, you look at simple metrics. I mean, median income. If we could get our median income, our household income up here, that would be a plus. And I always look at real estate values. You know, our housing values have really been, you know, treading water at best and shrinking a bit at worst. If we can get our housing values to bounce back a little bit, I think that would be a measure of success also.
Is that something President Trump can affect, do you think?
Well, we're going to find out. If we can get a few of the large-scale port-related projects up and running here, we could see some improvements to these metrics, yeah.
Are these projects that wouldn't have happened under President Clinton, but they might under President Trump?
I believe that's true.
You know, I always talk to my kids about how part of being a grown-up is dealing with trade-offs. Nothing is free. Everything's got a trade-off. How do the people of Grays Harbor grapple with or see trade-offs between resource jobs and the environment? What does that look like in Grays Harbor?
Well, we're on the front line of that trade-off of those issues. And I think that this area has been a good teammate for a lot of environmental policy that I would consider extreme. And I think this area is starting to buckle with the idea of continuing to cooperate and support that kind of policy. And I think this area is looking for ways. I mean, we don't expect that the timber industry will ever return to what it was in the 70s and before completely, but we'd like to get some of our timber industry back, and I think that's a reasonable expectation and a reasonable desire. You know, the mills are another matter. The mills are a longer-term proposition, and everyone knows that, but if we were able to really affect what Trump calls smart trade instead of just free trade, we might be able to do some things that would affect some policy that would make reopening mills at least a realistic hope instead of an unrealistic hope.
We're all watching Trump day by day to see what the president will actually do. And he has said a few things about planning to deport 2 to 3 million undocumented immigrants with criminal records and appointing Supreme Court justices that will overturn Roe versus Wade. He's talked more about the border wall that might be just a fence in some places. How what sense do you get about how the president-elect signals so far fit with what Grace Harper wants from him?
I don't know that our voters here hang on every single interview that the president-elect gives. I think that they are hopeful broadly that he can make things better here, a little bit better. I think everyone knows that the president isn't a king. I mean, the president can't change everything. But I think they think that the president can set a tone and set a large set of priorities for what the federal government will do. And I think people are cautiously optimistic that this will be a better few years than the last 20 or 30 have been.
How do you feel about the talk? And you're in Western Washington. The talk is coming from not far away. And even disappointed people in your county, Jim, how do you feel about the charge that a Trump voter is a vote for racism, for misogyny, for bigotry, mocking disabled people, on and on?
It's just not true. I believe that people who voted for Donald Trump here and elsewhere, but here is what I know most, really took a measured approach. They do not support all those things, all the bad things that people say about this politician. You know, I think they take a measured support and they want what's best for themselves and their area. I do not think that a vote for this man is an endorsement of racism or bigotry. And I am concerned that people outside of Grays Harbor in this area think that that's what that means about this area. It's really not true. This is people, this is voters who want their home county to recover. And I think that's what they're voting for.
Jim Walsh chairs the Republican Party in Grays Harbor County, which voted Trump. First time Grays Harbor has gone presidential Republican in about 90 years. Also voting Trump in Western Washington, Pacific, Mason, and Cowlitz counties all flipped from President Obama. So that's the coast and part of the Kitsap Peninsula and along the Western Columbia River. This is KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW Seattle on Twitter at KUOW. You know how alluring it is to get the behind-the-scenes dirt on your favorite celebrities? Well, Nancy Pearl feels the same way about the literary scene. That's why she brings you this new book.
Terry McDonnell, The Accidental Life, An Editor's Notes on Writing and Writers. Remember last month I talked about Robert Gottlieb's memoir. And Robert Gottlieb, famous, well-known editor at Random House, and then went over to The New Yorker. So at the same time I was reading that, I was reading Terry McDonnell. And Terry McDonnell was an editor at many magazines. He was at Outside. He was at Newsweek. He was at Esquire, Rolling Stone. And he's written in this book a series of short essays, and I was tickled to see that each one has its word count next to the title, as one does. And then it ends, each one ends with the end it in one word, so that you know that it's done when the editor is reading it. And this is a collection of just short pieces, both about editing and writing, but what I read it for was all the people that he's worked with over the years, and surprising people that I would not have thought were writers in the sense that for magazines. So one of them is Jimmy Buffett. Now, I'm a big Jimmy Buffett fan, but I didn't know I knew he wrote songs, and I love many of his songs, but I sure didn't know that he was a friend of Terry McDonnell, of whom I had never heard. Let's be honest here. There's a lot in this book about Hunter S. Thompson. It's always fun to read.
One of the things I'm wondering as you're talking is whether a good editor has to be a good writer. Is Terry McDonnell a good writer as well as a good editor, or is it just that these stories are sort of juicy?
I think that's a great question. I don't think he's a great writer, because I think if he had been a great writer, he would have written. But I think that being a good editor is probably even more important than being a good writer. I know from my own experience what a good editor can do, and I also know that I could never, ever be an editor because I know when something's wrong or when it doesn't work for me in an essay or a novel or whatever, but I don't read in the way that would tell me what this person could do to make it right.
I was speaking with some friends about the whole notion of editors and various art forms, and literature is really the one art form that you don't think of as collaborative, but that relationship between a writer and an editor really is a working partnership.
Right, and we only hear about it when it goes badly wrong or when the writer years later comes out, and like with Raymond Carver, comes and Gordon Lish comes out and says, basically, these are not the stories that I wrote. But it is collaborative, and you often think maybe that editor's name should be, instead of just being thanked at the end, which writers do and should do, it should be in some ways a co-author.
That's Nancy Pearl and KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman discussing the new book, The Accidental Life, by Terry McDonnell. You'll find all of Nancy's book recommendations at KUOW.org. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Did Facebook help elect Donald Trump? Since the election, Facebook's been accused of hosting lies and filtering out opposing views in a way that helped Trump. Here to comment is the founder of the Seattle-based tech news site GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
Did Facebook help elect Trump?
In some respects, yes. Now, Mark Zuckerberg has come out and said adamantly no, Facebook did not influence the election, let alone elect Trump. But it's a very difficult thread for them to go for because, on one hand, Facebook is telling advertisers that they influence purchasing decisions.
Right. What's on Facebook is hugely influential, advertisers.
Absolutely. And on the other hand, they are automatically tuning your newsfeed to deliver views and opinions that you find valuable based on your past actions. Now, that has the effect of creating an echo chamber where you are seeing things that you like, i.e. views about candidates that you like, and not seeing views from people who support opposing candidates. So there is a lot of
influence. Now Zuckerberg's saying, not that influential, actually.
Exactly. And there's a couple different components here. First, there's the element of fake news.
Yeah.
And there were a series of stories, including some that Facebook accidentally elevated to a show to a larger audience. There was one about the Pope endorsing
Pope Francis endorses Trump.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And then there is also the echo chamber. Now, on the first point, Mark Zuckerberg says that only a small fraction of stories on Facebook are fake and that they are bipartisan, essentially.
Right. Liberals and conservatives, and it's a small percentage.
Exactly. So that's their argument there. I will say, though, there have been reports coming out over the past few days saying this is an active debate inside Facebook. So even as Mark Zuckerberg is coming out publicly and saying, no, we did not influence the election, and also fake stories don't have a big impact on people, and if they do, it's a bipartisan impact, Facebook itself is having a bit of a identity crisis over this inside the company.
Why? What is that counter argument inside the company?
The fact that the algorithm, because of the way it operates, tends to create that bubble. And I think people experience this themselves as they go through Facebook. You know, it is monitoring what you click on, what you like, and trying to give you more of that. And so it creates this natural phenomenon of reinforcing your political views, your views of the world, and also the fact that you liked your friend Joe's picture of his kids from a few months back, so they're going to show you more of those. It's all in the same bucket, and it just happens to be that the political publications can actually influence the outcome of the country and the direction of where we're headed.
How much do you think Facebook is responsible for what you see, and how much are you responsible as the user?
It's a combination of the two.
Yeah.
Think about this. Back in the day, it was purely your choice of newspaper or maybe your choice of radio broadcast or TV station. And there it was the same kind of dynamic where you chose the platform, but then the editors were making the choice about what you actually saw. Here, the challenge is that it's an algorithm. So this is in some ways a glimpse of our AI future. We will have robots making these decisions that humans used to make on that other side of the coin. And so it is kind of a collaboration between humans, the people who are actually viewing the content, and also the robots. Now, Facebook does use humans to inform the algorithm at times. Now, this is separate from the whole controversy over the trending news section where they had some human editors who were suppressing conservative views.
Right, they got fired.
Yeah, so there was that whole controversy. But separate from that, Facebook does have a panel that helps inform the algorithm. So in other words, it's saying to the robots, hey, this is what people might like. And so it's kind of this complex stew of computers, programming, and human behavior that leads to what you see in your Facebook newsfeed. But the bottom line is it tends to go back to the things that you liked from the beginning. Not necessarily you clicked to like, but that you at least engaged with in some fashion.
And Zuckerberg publicly is saying you don't want us jumping in and censoring or favoring one side or the other, right? He seems to think that's a tricky road to go down.
Facebook is in a very difficult position here, if you think about it, because they are essentially trying to give you a feed that you'll like, that you'll appreciate. And it gets down to the fundamental elements of democracy, though, that opposing viewpoints are valuable, even if you don't enjoy hearing them. And I think that's really at the core of what we faced in this election and one of the reasons why the outcome was so surprising to people. And so many people get their news from Facebook as the front page, essentially, of their view into the world, that you have to think that it influenced in some fashion. Now, was it enough to actually elect Trump? I don't know.
That's
the answer to that.
That's a different question.
But one thing that Mark Zuckerberg did say was that they're open to changes. In fact, they make changes in the newsfeed algorithm regularly. In some cases, those have hurt publishers, and in other cases, they've promoted things that Facebook really wanted to get out, like Facebook Live videos. I would not be surprised if in a month or two, we hear about a major change in the Facebook algorithm that would promote opposing views or expose people more to things that they might not otherwise see or necessarily like.
Wow, that would be fascinating. Would that send Facebook stock dropping?
I don't think so. I think that would essentially show that they're listening and responding. And if anything, it might make people more likely to go to Facebook because they know they're not going to fall into this trap that we all just did.
We'll find out. Todd Bishop from GeekWire, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
And on KOW's Facebook page, you will find allies and alternative takes on the world, so be warned. Same for Twitter, @KUOW. Thanks for tuning in.